Accession number 27272, Mr. Malcolm Frost, Reel 5. Now, when you were in this transit camp, what were your first impressions of Korea as a country? What, Busan, Korea, as a country?
It was hot, dusty, inhospitable, and there was nothing at that point that was attractive about it. I mean, it was barren. The area around Busan was quite barren. We were in tented accommodation for the short period we were there, and that was it basically. I mean, it was.
What about the climate generally?
It was hot. It was August, and it was hot. Certainly, when we moved north to join the battalion, it was extremely hot.
Now you were only in the camp a couple of days. Anything happened?
A few days.
Prickly heat.
No. We were there just a few days. We didn't do anything other than prepare for being moved up to.
What sort of preparations could you make? Was there anything serious, or was it?
No, it was just basically getting ready to move. We'd make sure we got all the kit and just getting ready to move to join the battalion.
It's a draft again, of course.
Draft,
same draft.
Yeah.
Now, what battalion were you joining, and where did you join? What was the journey like to join them?
We were joining the 1st Battalion Royal Fusiliers. We went up by train, if I remember rightly, to the place where the battalion was located.
Do you know the name, or?
No, I honestly don't remember the name where it was. It was somewhere where we camped, where we stayed for a brief spell before we took our first sort of spell in the front line.
Now you've told me before off tape that you're not too good on place names and things of this period because you lost your diary, unfortunately. And
yeah, I did.
And we haven't got a history of the first Royal Fusiliers at the time. So, did anything about that train journey stick in your mind?
No, just viewing the sort of rather desolate countryside, and bearing in mind that. It had been sort of ravaged during the early part of the Korean War when the North Korean forces had got within a few miles from Busan, having taken the capital and then moving south. So really it was just sort of looking at the countryside and getting a feel for the country. It was not a long trip, I can't remember, just 2 or 3 hours, probably 3 or 4 hours.
Now, what happened when you got there? I mean, did you know you were joining the 1st, or did you think you were going to join the Norfolk?
No, we were told we were going to join the Fusiliers.
Now, what sort of reception did you get? You got a bad reception, you felt, off the Middlesex. What did you get off the...
We got a totally different reception from the Fusiliers. We were welcomed, to be totally honest. I suppose because we were making up numbers for a start. They were quite short of numbers, having just transferred from Germany. I mean, their battalion was made up of quite a fair number of Second World War veterans and National Servicemen as well, and we were virtually all National Servicemen who were joining them. No, we were well treated by the battalion. It was that point where they made the selection as to which company we were going to go into, and it was at that point where I volunteered for signals on the basis that it seemed to needed a bit of intelligence perhaps, and I was accepted as a signaller and was given signals training in wireless procedures and line processes.
Now, were you therefore put in headquarters company for
that? Yeah, I was in HQ company, yeah.
Was that what you were in all the time with?
I was in headquarter company, but attached for quite a while to support company. But then went back to headquarters company subsequently.
So that was your route home, was a headquarters company?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you just decided that signals duty offered a bit more?
I didn't have any great sort of understanding of what all the various aspects were going to be. Just that signals appealed to me and that it seemed to be something a bit different. And I felt that one needed to be perhaps a little bit sort of, well, not more intelligent, but perhaps grasping things a bit more quickly if you were going to be a signaller.
So you felt you could do a good job of it?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, take me through the who trained you? I mean...
I was trained by... there were two signal sergeants, Messrs Hill and Harrison, and they, plus the other NCOs who were already with the battalion and already in the signals platoon, did the training, so we were trained.
And what were the signal sergeants like?
Joe Hill, he was a lovely fella. I've met him subsequently since two or three times, having been back. There was a Corporal Lockermother who I have kept in touch with ever since, and Corporal Randall. The signal platoon NCOs were excellent NCOs and were keen to train us.
Now, take me through the training. How did they, because we are always interested in training.
Well,
how did they train you as a signal? We were taught
initially on the 88, small 88 set, which was used by platoons in the forward companies.
What is the 88?
It's a small 88 set is a small set. The battery is in one pouch and the set is in another, actually housed on your belt with earphones and a microphone. So we were taught to operate those.
How heavy is it?
It's just a few pounds, not very heavy.
And what is it you have to learn to operate?
You've got to learn the wireless procedure. That's the point. You've got all everything had a code name. I mean, you know, there's the Sunray, and you never spoke about the intelligence officer or the CO or the adjutant. They all had, and I don't remember those. I remember Sunray, and I can't. But you had to learn wireless procedure, and it was a very close type procedure. So you were taught to use the 88 set. Then you were taught on the 31, which was the backpack set, which was the bigger set, which was on a cradle on your back. But again, you were just really carrying on learning the radio procedure. And then you were trained on the 19, which was a set where you kept in touch with other units in the brigade. And it had a greater range than the 31 set. So those were the three principal radio sets, with the 88, the 31, and the 19. And then,
so the 88 was very portable. The 31 was portable.
The 19 was always in a cradle, in a jeep, or wherever you were based as a temporary base.
Now, learning to use them, I mean, did that mean just learning to tune them in, learning that?
You had to, I mean, the 19 set you could tune, 31 set you had a set channel.
So that wasn't, you just had one.
Yeah, but when the battalion established itself in a position, first thing they did was set up radio contact, and that was done on the 31 set. So all the platoons, all the companies had to call in, and you had so many stations, all of which had to call in on this code name to prove that you had established contact. Then you would make sure that you had line contact with field telephones, and so you had complete control and contact throughout the battalion. So you learnt those processes. You also learnt to lay lines in the dark.
I was just going to ask about that, because you just mentioned it. What about the telephone side? Because you've got the wireless side.
Yeah, telephone. You had field telephones. You had J sets and normal sets. Now, you basically were taught to lay lines. You had to learn how to tie them back so that they.
How did you lay?
Well, we had night exercise, because we still hadn't gone into the line in this. We were still held back in a reserve position. You had to learn to lay lines. You had to later learn them in the dark. You had to learn how to tie them back into bushes and trees to make sure that they didn't get cut by jeeps and tanks and things. And you had to prove that you could lay a line, stick a telephone, a field telephone on the end, and ring up and prove that you had actually laid a line and made contact. So there was that sort of element of training.
Were you also trained in repairing lines? Because, I mean, lines get cut.
You were trained in repairing lines, but fortunately I never got stuck with repairing or having to repair a shrapnel or bomb damaged line, but you were trained to do that.
What about
switchboard? We had to learn switchboard. There were two types of switchboard that I got involved with. One, which was a diabolical switchboard that I had when I was attached to a support company, and that was a crystal set. Now, what is a crystal set, you might ask? Well, the lines came into a clear Perspex plug, which had a little neon light that illuminated. They didn't ring, flashed. You had to slot. It had two. It had the bottom bit was a receptacle with two holes in. The bit that you were making contact with had two pins, which you inserted into the holes, and you could actually build up a joint sort of conference if you wanted to by plugging in two or three people into the same slot, so you could have this sort of pile of crystal type. It's difficult to describe, like almost like a castle of crystals, but normally it was just one in one to one.
And what was the problem with it? Other than
the problem was you had to watch the blasted thing, and you could miss a call, which I did on one or two occasions, particularly from the platoon commander. I got bollocked on more than one occasion, particularly at night time when you were
fitting. Was it an effective? If you saw it, did it work okay?
It worked, yeah, and you just had to sort of keep your eye on it. The other type of exchange was the one where the flaps dropped, and they had those back at Headquarter Company, and when I became Signals Corporal back at Headquarter Company and used the other exchange, and then they gradually established these better exchanges in the outposts as well.
So how did these ones work?
They're like a conventional civvy type exchange, basically. You had jack plugs, which you took a call, you plugged the jack plug into the appropriate point, and that was it. But I mean, you had people who were probably better switchboard operators, and particularly in battalion headquarters, you had somebody who more or less specialised on switchboard.
But anything else you were learning as a signaller? What about batteries?
Fair bit. Well, we learned to charge batteries. We had chore horses for charging batteries, but again, battalion had couple of people who did all the battery charging. A chap called Pip Piper used to do our batteries, but we learned how to hook batteries up to charge them up in series, and we learned that element. But again, later on, that was done by a small specialist team, because you didn't have the facility in all locations you were in to undertake battery charging.
The other thing is,
well, by the way, the 31 set had a dry battery, which was strapped under the actual set, but the 19 set had an accumulator type charge battery. So that was the sort of difference.
What about repairs or even changing? I presume most of them were valves.
You knew very little about repair. Again, that was done by specialists. All battalions had a Remy attachment with them, and the Remy Royal Electromechanical Engineer people did all the sort of maintenance and repair of all your bits and pieces, like they did all the armoury repair, weapons and so on.
It was all telephony, so there's no learning Morse or.
No, didn't do any Morse at all. It was all speech.
There was no fallback, you know. Anything else you were learning with them?
No, that's about it. I think I learned all the wireless techniques. And
how long did it take you?
In terms of training, probably basic training in probably about 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And then you guys learned on the job. If you went wrong, which I did on one or two occasions, and
so what early mistakes did you make?
Having sort of been trained as a signaller, we were then allocated to companies. No. And I was allocated to support company, which was MMGs, 3-inch mortar platoon, Pioneers, and I got attached to 3-inch mortar platoon, and there were three signallers attached to the platoon itself. The two previous signallers, one was a Lance Corporal, the other was a Fusilier, but both of them were experienced signallers, and I was attached to them as a raw recruit. And they left me on the first day that we were established in one of the line positions, and I didn't realise that I had to sort of answer a communication call, and I got a bollocking because I wasn't on air when I should have been. But that wasn't, I didn't really feel that was my fault. I felt that was the NCO's fault, who was in charge of a small unit. But yeah, I became attached to support company.
Now, where were this is still not in the line.
No, we'd gone. Then we've actually moved into the line.
Now, what when you enter this the 3-inch?
Three mortar platoon. Yeah.
So where were you moving up into the line?
Into positions. I mean, this was the thing with support company. The mortar platoon were always a bit behind the actual front line, so to speak. But we.
Now, do you know which sector you were in? I know you had trouble with where.
We were in the.
Is it Koang Sang?
I'm trying to think.
Any hills you do know?
I can't think. I'm totally honest. It's the one thing that escapes me. I remember a lot, but I don't remember that. I mean, I know that we just moved forward into a forward active position, and with support company with the mortars, we were a mile or half a mile behind the line into fortified bunkers. And that was where we first took over sort of the responsibility of communication with the other platoons and areas in the battalion.
Well, tell us about the bunkers, because people are always interested in the bunkers.
We dug in on the hillside with bunkers which had.
Had you dug them, or were they?
They were there. All the positions we moved into were all established positions that had happened, because at the time that we got there in 52, the line had been established, and basically, I think the order had been made because. Peace talks were going on at Pamijan that there was to be no active offence, it was merely patrol work and defence. And so, as far as we were concerned, we sat in a position where we were sitting where people had sat before. We took over from the Americans in one sector on one occasion.
Can you describe a bunker? Because in as much detail as you can.
It was dug into the hillside. It was.
How big?
It was large enough for. There was a command post bunker, a control bunker, which was quite large. It had a couple of trestle tables in with the exchange on, the radio sets. The platoon commander was established there, and that was sort of the main bunker, the control.
And that was burrowed into the side of the
hill. It was cut into the side of the hill. It was then large logs. Most of the bunkers had very large sort of timbers in the roof, on which were then placed sandbags and then covered with earth. The doors, the front area was sandbagged up with double row of sandbags, and then you had just a small entrance. The actual individual bunkers were big enough to house three individuals, usually. Obviously, there were trenches, and when I was with the 3-inch mortar platoon, all the mortar pits were all pre-dug anyway for the mortars to stand in. But we had beds that we made ourselves from metal pickets with cable. We slept on those in sleeping bags with a mosquito net. In the winter, we had what we call chuff boxes, which were heaters made from metal aluminium, metal ammunition chests, which had the lid. They would describe the lid was cut in half, and we then had a drip with a jerry can of diesel outside, and you drip diesel into the base of the ammunition box, and you had a chimney which went out somewhere through the side of the bunker to keep you warm, because I think anybody who served in Korea, the two things that will stick in their mind would be the heat of the summer and the intense cold of the winter.
We'll come back to that. Now, anything else in your individual bunker? I mean, what were you sleeping on?
Sleeping on a homemade or a bed that we made with strung cable, basically meshed like basketball work, which we made ourselves. And then just a sleeping bag. That was a sleeping bag and a blanket.
Wood,
and
with wood at
the... Well, they were metal pickets, actually, what we call metal stakes, which were strapped together. And then we interlaced them with this wire to make sort of like almost a sprung base. It wasn't springy, but it was that we laid on in a sleeping bag that we were provided with, which had a hood and a zip.
Any other furniture? I mean, I know it's not...
Nothing. Nothing. Box, wooden box, which perhaps to sit on, that was it. Somewhere to...
How big? Sink. An individual one, how big?
It would be... Small size of a small bedroom, I suppose, about 8 by 10, something like that. 8 by.
And how high? Normal height.
Normal height, about 7 foot high, I suppose.
So quite substantial.
Yeah, quite.
What about the main one, the command post? That would be much.
That bigger. Was quite big. Yeah, that was say big enough for two trestle tables side by side, seating, the exchange for the 19 set to stand on for your radio. Communication, so that was quite all the maps would be set out. That would be linked to any forward post for observation purposes. So it was quite extensive, the command post. The battalion command post was very large.
Now, so what about the food there? I mean, you know, the food you've got.
We were fed initially. For quite a long period on American combat rations, sea rations. There's a 24-hour pack in a wax carton. It contained everything you needed for 24 hours.
Now, what was this US stuff like?
It wasn't bad. You got your 20 cigarettes, which I always found I had to try and exchange my Camel for Lucky Strike or Philip Morris because... I couldn't stand the Camel, they were a bit too strong. There were at least 3 meat dishes.
Now, what kind of meat?
Frankfurters and beans, corned beef hash, those sort of canned food. There was tin fruit, a small can opener, toilet paper. That was it, basically.
Now, what did you think of this? I mean, because you'd had experience with the Americans before, but British people often found American food a little rich or...
I hated the corned beef hash.
Why?
Because it was horrible. I mean, it was corned beef and potatoes sort of mashed up in the tin, and I just didn't like it. And
you preferred just to have British corned beef?
I preferred to have bully beef. After some, I can't remember exactly how long we were on. We were on sea rations quite a while.
Hang on, before you go to what happened there, what about the other American meat foods?
I mean, no, we didn't have any. We just had a combat pack.
No, but you said there were 3 types of meat meal.
Well, there was Frankfurters and...
What were they like?
Well, they were sort of the hot dog sausages, you know, and there was nothing very special.
You didn't like
them? I didn't like them very much, but they were palatable and that was it. But I think we all appreciate the fact we got 20 fags a day, and we also got the 50 free issue from the British government, so we were well fixed for cigarettes. And I must admit, I did smoke a lot while I was abroad. I mean, when you're on night duty, to keep yourself awake, looking at this blasted crystal exchange, I used to keep myself awake by smoking. And that
when
was
did
it.
You started smoking? Before you went in the army?
Yeah, no, I didn't smoke.
So it was the army that started was it? I mean, was it just everyone else did what?
Well, I think I was offered a cigarette and I took it and eventually just sort of fell into smoking. And I mean, the fact that we had these free issue when we got to Korea, I mean, it was just something you did. You always handed them around and you got them handed around to you. And so you it was just a sort of a social contact almost, to hand around a can of cigarettes and have a fag together. That was it. Yeah.
And any other rations? Well, when
we were in the line, we originally had combat rations, American combat rations, but then we went on to the 10-man British compo packs.
Now, what about
now they were better.
Now, why were they better? What
well,
was
because
in
it was well, you had things you had to cook. You cooked them. Well, I mean, you cooked the American things over a little burner that was provided in their pack. But here, you actually were expected to make a meal between 10 of you, and you had canned fruit cake. There was nice, quite mature canned cheese. There was biscuits. There was bully beef. There was exactly the same packs they used in the Second World War, I assumed, because in fact some of them were dated around about the 1947-48. But we had to make our meals somehow between us out of compo packs when we were in the line. When we got back in reserve, then we actually had cooks who cooked in the cookhouse, and we were governed normal beings.
So how would you, because you were only three of you in a thing, how did you actually get sort out the cook?
Well,
who would do it?
Well, because we became part of the mortar platoon. I mean, we regarded as members of the platoon, although we were signals attached. So when we got to the point where we were getting 10-man ration packs, I can't remember the exact number who were in the platoon. I think the platoon was about 30 strong. So there were at least three packs, which then somebody had to take responsibility for sharing out and providing meals. So we just joined in with the rest of the
mob
platoon.
Who would do the cooking? That's
some
I mean.
Somebody had to volunteer. And
Well,
I did. I mean, we didn't. The same person didn't do it all the time.
Was it different? Was it mainly a matter of heating them up?
Heating up stuff, yeah. Opening cans, dishing it out. Yeah, that was it, to be honest.
You definitely preferred this?
Oh, the English rations, I much preferred the American. There were no cigarettes in it. That was possibly the downside of it, but the food itself was more traditional.
And you got
English
50
food
from the British government anyway.
Yeah, a can of 50.
You didn't get the 20 extra.
No.